I'm Gail Harris and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. The sound of fighting this morning in Kut. It wasn't supposed to be this way, but then little has gone according to Pentagon plan or expectations since the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled from its pedestal in Firdaus Square 1 year ago today. Well, not much applause these days in Baghdad. Civil war between Sunni and Shia Muslims struggling for power in a post-Saddam world would have been bad enough. But what's happened over the past few days has been even more ominous, with angry Iraqis from both groups uniting against the Americans. The Pentagon is considering sending in more troops to Iraq. Do you think that's the answer? How should American troops react to new Muslim militias? 1 year later, is the U.S. where you expected after troops rolled so easily into Baghdad? And is the latest violence just a speed bump on the road to a more democratic Iraq, or the beginning of a new and even more dangerous spiral? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have several guests this hour to help us analyze what's happening and why. First, we turn to Thanasi Kambanis of the Boston Globe for the latest news from Baghdad and elsewhere. Hi, Thanasi.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Very well, thanks. More importantly, how are you and what's happening so far today?
Well, it's been a day that we've been nervous about all week since Iraq seemed to revert to war last weekend. And I think we have expected April 9th to bring any number of untold events. Unfortunately, for now, it hasn't happened. But what's remarkable about today, and having been here a year ago today and being here now, it's remarkable how similar it feels in Iraq as it did at the end of the war, except that last April 9th, people were a lot more cheerful. People were rejoicing at the fall of Saddam Hussein, and there was a sense of optimism in the air. Now, pretty much everywhere you go, there's foreboding. From the west end of Baghdad, where military convoys were attacked and destroyed in Abu Ghraib, to the north of the city, where people have been kidnapped, to the northeast of the city, where hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims gathered today to pledge their fealty to Muqtada al-Sadr and his cause of revolt against the U.S. occupation.
And also, I understand there is a religious holiday underway. How is that complicating the situation?
Well, there's sort of three things at work. One which sort of went under the radar, which is April 7th, apparently, was the anniversary of the founding of the Ba'ath Party, April 9th being the year anniversary of the invasion or the toppling of the government, and then Sunday is the culmination of Arbayin, which is the 40-day Shiite observance of the death of Imam Hussein, Imam Ali, excuse me, and that is Hussein, sorry. And that culminates with a pilgrimage to Karbala, where several millions of Shiites walk from all over the country. At the beginning of this 40 days in early March, we saw more than 100 people killed in bombing attacks, and there was a lot of fear of repeat attacks now. We haven't seen that yet. However, this is the most intense period for Shiites religiously, so that superimposed on the anniversary of the invasion, superimposed with the emotions running high with the images of civilian casualties from Fallujah, have spelled a very, very worked-up populace.
And I understand you were at a religious service this morning?
Yes. Sadr City, the Shiite area of anywhere from 2 to 3 million Shiites are estimated to live in Sadr City. It's part of Baghdad, but it functions basically as its own fiefdom. That's where the fierce fighting occurred on Sunday night, where at least 8 American soldiers were killed in ambushes. And that's the stronghold of Muqtada al-Sadr, the cleric who's behind the revolts in Kut and Najaf and Karbala and other parts around the country. And today was a very unusual day there. I've been to Friday prayer services there many times. Today there was something in the order of maybe 300,000 people, usually 10 to 20. In addition to the usual images of Shiite ayatollahs and of Muqtada al-Sadr, they were carrying Iraqi flags, and that's a national symbol that you don't often see. They had invited Sunnis to take part in the service, and at the end, the imam had everyone link hands and chant Fallujah and Mokhtada hand in hand to throw out the Americans. And that was a very striking image in a place where Sunnis have not been traditionally welcomed.
I can imagine. And also, it seems to illustrate the tightrope that U.S. troops are having to walk there, because they're trying to put down an insurgency without it looking like they are against all Muslims.
Right. And, I mean, you touched on something very important in your introduction, which I haven't heard enough of, I think, from U.S. officials, which is it's not a question of civil war breaking out at this point. It's a question of will this uprising that's being referred to already as the Intifada spread beyond where it already has. And it certainly, sympathy for this lies certainly with the greater portion of the population than a small disenfranchised Baptist minority. And it only takes a look at what's happening in Fallujah, or a look at the mass outpouring in Baghdad of people sending relief supplies to that city, people setting aside their sectarian differences to say, you know, all Iraq is Fallujah. We are all, you know, we are all victims of this occupation. And you see thousands upon thousands of folks who are traditionally who seemed moderate a few weeks ago, incredibly angry. And so it's hard to tell how many thousands are actively participating in the insurgency at this point, but it's certainly a huge portion of the population sympathizes with it.
Well, Thanasi, we thank you so much for keeping us up to date, and please stay safe.
Thank you, Gail. Take care.
Well, keeping up the troop strength in Iraq has meant extending the tour of duty for thousands of U.S. troops who had been expecting to come home by now. Tony Hillman is a Massachusetts National Guardsman who was supposed to return home this month, and now his family isn't sure when that might happen. His mother, Kathy, is joining us on the line from her home in Scituate, Massachusetts. Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
What's the latest you've heard from Tony?
We haven't heard anything this week. His spirits was good, but it was very, very tense when he spoke to him last.
And what is his job there?
He's in transportation. He's part of 1058 from Hingham. He's first class sergeant in the unit.
And how much are you keeping up with the news, especially this past week? Are you glued to it, or are you trying not to listen?
I'm trying not to listen. I try to avoid it, and I just keep hoping that everything goes well. I think these soldiers need a great deal of support, and by concentrating on the negative is not. I think we have to concentrate only on the positive. They're there to do a job. They are at war, whether the government say they are at war, they actually are at war, and they're fighting for their lives, all these men and women, and I hope the American people don't forget that. It really is war. If Mr. Bush walked there now and went along with him, it would have to be war. And I really would like to say thank you to the president of the Prime Minister of Japan for his support, because he has the right idea. We are fighting terrorists. We are not fighting the Muslim people. We are fighting terrorists, and that's what my son and many other people went out there to do. They didn't go to fight Muslims. This is not a religious war. This is a war about terrorism, and if we back down now, we will know what terrorism is about.
And, Kathy, when you hear the Pentagon say that they're ready to send more troops in as needed, do you think that's the way to go, even if it means that your son and others may not get to come home as quickly as you'd prefer?
I think we are out. My son and other men are out, and women are out there to do a job. Let them, allow them to do the job. Don't tie their hands saying, you can't do this. They shouldn't have to make choices of saying, oh, well, he looks innocent and he doesn't. I mean, last week a young man, a soldier, confiscated a vehicle. That young man has now gone to jail for a year because he made a bad choice. He confiscated the car because he thought the driver could have been dangerous. If he had have allowed him to go ahead and he'd have run into a troop and it had all got blasted up, then he would have still been wrong. I think the American people should... People do make bad choices, but he was far better making the choice he did than allowing somebody else to be killed.
Well, Kathy, we thank you, and
thank
we
you.
Join you in looking forward to Tony's safe return.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now for a broader view of the strategic decisions that are being made in this new round of fighting, we turn to urban war expert Colonel Randy Gangell, who joins us from a studio in Arlington, Virginia. He is executive director of the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities. That's a Washington think tank whose mission is to determine solutions to national security threats in support of Marine forces. And in that role, he also speaks with senior commanders and junior Marines before and after their deployment in Iraq. Welcome, Colonel.
Thank you very much.
Is this, in fact, the war that that the U.S. never wanted, really thought it would not have to fight or hoped it would not have to fight?
I think there's a lot of evidence that points to that, that we anticipated a different reaction from the population than what we're seeing today. And certainly in our Marine Corps preparations to return, which we did just recently and starting in February, the type of training that we focused on was not the type of combat we're seeing today.
And I also want to bring Pam Hess into the conversation. She's the Pentagon correspondent for United Press International, and she is with Colonel Gangell in Virginia. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, pleasure to have you back with us. What's your sense? Is this, in your view, the war that the U.S. was hoping it wouldn't have to fight?
If you remember the original war plan and actually the way it was executed, it was a really interesting and pretty bold plan that Tommy Franks came up with, which is he wanted to avoid urban warfare because he knew that's where a lot of civilians would get killed, and indeed a lot of his men would get killed, or his men and women. And so the plan that he came up with had the army, which was going to strike on Baghdad, largely swinging wide of the cities, with the Marines sort of running interference for them. And the Marines did get caught up in some urban combat, but for the most part, it was on the outskirts of cities like Fallujah and Najaf and Nasiriyah. the intention was, as Colonel Gangell said, the intention was to strike Baghdad, topple Saddam Hussein, and then the gamble was that things would improve so much in Iraq that anyone who might want to oppose the coalition would see, things are better, and put down their guns and move along. One of the other problems that they had was Turkey refused to allow the 4th Infantry Division to come in from the north and have a northern front going on, which would have squeezed anybody that any Saddam loyalists that fled from the south up to the north. It could have stopped them there. But that northern front never happened. So there was a lot of sanctuary for people who wanted to wait and fight. And there's some evidence that that was part of the plan that Saddam Hussein's men had all along, which was to put down their weapons, wait for a while, regroup, and then begin fighting. And I think that might be what we're seeing now. I did ask General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, about this at the Pentagon 2 days ago, and he said they don't think that that original war plan was a mistake, that it was humane and it was the right thing to do at the time. I've talked to a general that's in the field there now who's fighting in Fallujah, and he agreed. He thinks that this is not an outcrop of the way that the war was fought. But I think you're going to probably see a lot more analysis of that original war plan and whether or not it was the right thing to do, or did they just leave a lot of people there ready to fight another day.
All right, and we're going to continue our conversation after we take a break. We're talking this hour about the events in Iraq. Do you see this latest violence as the beginning of a new and dangerous spiral, or just a speed bump on the road to a more democratic Iraq? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR. We're talking about the violence in Iraq this hour. The Pentagon is considering sending in more troops. Do you think that's the answer? And 1 year later, is the U.S. where you expected it would be after troops rolled so easily into Baghdad? Joining us is Colonel Randy Gangell, Executive Director of the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities in Quantico, Virginia, and also Pam Hess, Pentagon Correspondent for United Press International. Colonel, I want to ask you about something that Kathy Hillman told us a moment ago about her son's experience and certainly the experience of others about it's not always clear who the enemy is there. And how prepared were U.S. troops to deal with that particular aspect of urban warfare?
I think we're very well prepared. We've been actually focusing the last 4 or 5 years on fighting what we call the asymmetric enemy. And we concentrated on the urban battle space because we recognize that that's where the trend of the future is. If you're going to oppose the will of the United States or our armies, you cannot do it out in the traditional open terrain. We're just too powerful. So you have to take advantage of what is given to you. In this case, it's the urban population that you try to blend into. Furthermore, you don't put on a uniform so that you're easily identified by U.S. forces, all of which makes it a very complex environment. But we've trained to that. We teach our people how to identify, you know, hopefully identify the good people from the bad people. But obviously, if they put down their weapons, it's not as easy to do. So you have to interrogate people and gather. The important thing is that we need to gain the confidence of the people. And this is where the difficult part in Iraq is right now. Because if the people can identify who the gunmen are and the terrorists, insurgents, whatever you want to call them, then we don't have to kill innocent civilians or round up villages in order to accomplish our mission. And that's where the difficult part of this is right now, dealing with the psychological or what's known as the information operations side as well.
Mm. Well, Colonel, I wonder, does it make a difference from a strategic or tactical point of view whether you're dealing with a power grab from one person, someone like Assad, who's looking for a greater role for himself and for the Shia Muslims, or if what you're up against is Iraqis who have their own grievances about the U.S. Or against the U.S., that it's not necessarily religious so much as they have other issues?
Well, what you've just done is you've started to peel the onion back about the complexity of this Iraqi situation. You know, just sitting here off the top of my head, you have the interests of the Kurds, you have the Shias, you have the Sunnis, you have the secular population, you have Christian minorities, and you have the tribal aspect. All of these things make this a very, very complex situation. What I think we were hoping to achieve was a multi democratic society where everybody was a participant. What we're seeing happening on the ground is that the group that has been the majority of the country for centuries and been oppressed for centuries is blatantly making a grab for power. But even within the Shia community itself, there are those like Sadr who obviously or apparently would like to impose a regime similar to that in Tehran. And there are other Shias who are more moderate, like Ayatollah Sistani, who said, let's keep religion out of this to the extent possible. So it's a very complex situation, and it's difficult for me to sit here in Washington and try to Monday morning quarterback the men on the ground over there who are having to make hard decisions and dealing with this situation.
Mm. Gail, if I can add something here, the problem that you're seeing in Fallujah and Ramadi, a great deal of it comes from the fact that this was the point in Iraq where the black market that existed, a huge black market that existed under the UN oil for food embargo, developed, and Saddam Hussein allowed it to go. So what you're seeing is not necessarily people who are politically motivated or ideologically motivated, but when they say criminals and thugs, there's a heavy element of criminals and thugs there, people whose livelihood for the last 10 years has been dependent on them bringing in guns and cars and anything that would violate the embargo. So they see not just their sort of way of life being threatened, but their livelihood being threatened. And I think a way to think about it is that a large part of the resistance in Fallujah and Ramadi is criminal. It's almost organized crime.
So are more troops the answer? Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and hear from Dan. Hi, Dan. I'm sorry, Don.
That's okay. Hey, thanks very, very much for taking my call this morning.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
I know you referred to this as a speed bump earlier, just the additional insurgency we've experienced and everyone seen on TV and read in the newspapers of late. But I don't consider it a speed bump. I think that if we are to put more troops in that area, then I think we ought to make every effort in the world to go back and enlist the statesmanship of people like General Powell, Secretary of State Powell, I should say, and try to enlist more support from the UN and their troops. I don't think it's too late. I hope not anyway to undo some of the unilateral damage that this administration has done en route to our participation there and get additional help so that we're not the only ones, America, with some small assistance from other countries as well, of course. Not the only country that is in the line of sight all the time. I think that a lot of damage has been done. But that being said, and I do want to qualify everything I'm saying here. Being retired military myself, I support every person that's serving there now, and my heart goes out to every young man and woman that is in harm's way there now. It rips my heart out every day to see an additional person killed and multiple people. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Well, Don, we appreciate the call. Let's put that question to Colonel Gangel. And isn't that the issue? I mean, the international community doesn't seem to be very interested in getting more involved. In fact, Spain's talking about pulling its troops out. Bulgaria was asking for more help. And now we've got the Japanese hostages further complicating the situation.
Well, I kind of look at this in two perspectives. One, we made the decision to go unilaterally, let me rephrase that, with a couple of allies. And let's be very clear here. The British contribution is very significant. The British Army's size is about 70,000. They've got 10,000 troops down there right now. So their contribution is probably, in terms of relative terms, greater than ours in terms of manpower. And I certainly don't want to slight them in any way. But basically, the decision was made by our government and the British government to go in, regardless of what the international community's view was. I don't think the international community's view has changed very much, and it certainly seems to be, in the case of some of our coalition of the willing, now that the fighting has risen in some of the southern cities, that they're not much interested in fighting. In fact, we know of several instances where they've just basically handed over the cities and towns to the Mahdi forces and have not fought. So I don't know that is a solution to this problem we're facing right now, inviting the United Nations or other coalition of willing partners to come in. I think this is something that we're going to have to deal with ourselves.
And Pam, I'm wondering what you're hearing inside the building there, because we hear Secretary Rumsfeld and General Myers saying the right things. You know, we're resolved, we can fix this. But do you get a sense of an underlying unease or a concern within the
Pentagon? Actually, I don't. I happened to, after the briefing, I ran into General Myers on his way back to his office, and I asked him that question, that, you know, what's really going on in his heart about all of this? Is he troubled? And he said he's really not troubled, that he sees this as sort of a natural function. This fight was going to happen at some point because these guys weren't taken care of during the war. I think that one thing that's important to note, and perhaps Colonel Gangel would want to weigh in on this, is that throwing more troops at an urban fight is not necessarily the best way to go about doing it. What you need are, I think, smaller groups of well-trained forces that know how to do it. Just putting more people into an urban fight, in many cases, just sets up more targets. You want people who really know what they're doing to move through and do it as precisely as possible. I think when they're talking about needing more troops, it's if things get really out of control elsewhere in the country. There are, I think, six or seven cities where there are problems right now. Ramadi and Fallujah are the problems that deal with the, sort of the Sunni insurgents. And the other cities, Kut, which I think was retaken today by American forces, that was one of the cities where some coalition forces had backed off and allowed Sadr's men to take over. Samarra and some other places, those are the places where you have Sadr's militia standing up. And I also think it's important to point out about Sadr is that I don't believe that he has a great deal of popular support. He's the son of a grand Ayatollah who was slain by Saddam Hussein's men in 1999. They killed him and two of Sadr's brothers, and Sadr escaped to Iran. He's been trying to position himself as a political force and as a sort of an alternative. He's much too young and doesn't have the backing to get religious support, which is something he would also want. There's no way that he's going to topple Ali Sistani and become sort of the lead Shiite there. So he's been looking for an opportunity to cast himself as a political hero. And this is what has been visited upon him now. It is important to note that what has started all of this is that Sadr is now wanted for murder in the death of another Ayatollah exactly a year ago on the steps of the Imam Ali Mosque in Najaf. And that is why he's making his stand right now, because he's in danger of being put in jail and tried in an Iraqi court. So it's important to keep that in perspective as well, that this is not some coalescing, I think, of political agendas, but rather Sadr seeing that this is his last-ditch opportunity and really doing a brilliant job of taking advantage of it. The fact that he's wanted for murder is not something that you hear a lot on the news, and it's because he has managed to really control the public relations agenda here.
Although it is starting to come out now, let's go to another caller to Natick, Massachusetts. We're going to hear from Jim. Hello, Jim, and welcome.
Hi. I think that the issue here is that we've made a terrible mistake approaching this whole nest of problems as a military situation, invading Iraq. And if you just listen to the military people talk about imposing our will and then the difficulty of telling friend from foe and the civilian casualties, I mean, it's like Vietnam all over again. And who wants to be the one to send one more soldier over to die for a mistake? We've got to find non-military solution to our conflict with a large portion of the Muslim world. We've got to figure out what this war is really about and start trying to make peace.
Well, let's put that question to Colonel Gangel. And also, Colonel, there has been a reluctance, has there not, from the field to ask for more troops precisely because of those analogies about Vietnam. We heard this week from Senator Biden about he compared the current fighting to the Tet Offensive, which turned public opinion against the war in Vietnam.
Well, I think there's two questions that's been asked here. One is, should we continue the military operation? And the second is, do we need more forces to do it? My answer to the first question would be, or the first comment would be, whether or not it was a mistake to enter into the war in Iraq is beyond us now. But the point I think we need to recognize that we have now committed ourselves, and if we withdraw with our tail between our legs, so to speak, we will have put another victory in the terrorists, the worldwide terrorists' view of things. They bombed the coal. They were successful with no retribution. They forced us out of Beirut with the bombing of the Marine barracks. They forced us out of Somalia with the Black Hawk Down incident. At least in their view, that's how they view the world. If they can force us out of Iraq before we create a democracy of some form, they will view it as another victory against the West. Now, as to the second question, do we need more troops? I'm not on the ground. I'm not privileged to all the information that the commanders there have. But I will tell you that sitting here in my position, when I watch the events that have unfolded in the South concurrent with the events that are going on in Fallujah, it would appear to me that we did not have enough forces available to react to a multitude of incidents that occurred simultaneously. If Sadr did orchestrate this, it tells me that he or some of his chief lieutenants are excellent military planners, because they created a number of incidents in widespread locations. They chose their targets carefully, and they were very successful in forcing us out of several locations, and we had no forces available, or not enough forces available, to immediately respond at many locations. Hence, in my view, perhaps we do need some forces. But again, I'm not the commanding general on the ground either.
And Pam, what are you hearing as to the tipping point for more troops to be called for?
I think if the battles that we see ongoing right now, if Sadr's not handled relatively quickly, you might see more troops there. Already there's been an order that the 1st Armored Division, which is in Baghdad, is going to be staying longer. They were supposed to be pulling out in May, and I'm not sure when it is that they're going to be pulling out now. Some of them did get swung south, and I believe they're the ones that carried out the operation in Al-Kut. There is a reluctance to send more troops, and part of it has to do with the numbers of troops that we have committed around the world. Between Afghanistan and Iraq, with the major troop rotation that's going on now, the Army only has 10 divisions, and 8.5 of them have been involved in this troop rotation. So either they are committed to Afghanistan and Iraq, or they're just coming back from there and need rest and they need training before they can get ready to go. So there aren't a great number of options. Earlier, you were talking about the international forces there, and I think there's an important warning that has gone out from the NATO Secretary General, De Hoop Scheffer. He's new, and he said that unless there's a new UN resolution, some NATO countries that are currently committed to the forces in Iraq, come July 1st, when Iraq assumes sovereignty again, they might feel legally compelled to leave. There is a UN resolution allowing U.S. Or allowing international forces to be in Iraq to establish security, but there is some question whether or not that's good enough after the situation, the political situation, changes in Iraq. I think in May you might see a new UN resolution, and the U.S. and Great Britain are taking the lead on that. But it is a very important warning that some countries that already have some number of troops dedicated there and who are part of this coalition of the willing may feel legally compelled to pull back. Europe has a different view of international involvement than the U.S. does, and puts much greater stock in international law and the rationalizations for being in a place than the United States does.
All right, we're going to squeeze in one more call before we have to take a break. We've got John on the line from Newton. Hi, John.
Hi. You ask if we need more troops. I think yes, if the military says we need them. If they say we need more weapons, let's get them the weapons. Look, I'm willing to believe that with the elation of last spring and Hussein's toppling, we were overly optimistic, and nation building is a fiendishly difficult thing to do, more so than perhaps the Pentagon planners had imagined. However, the question is, now that we're there, what do we do? I recall Churchill's line upon assuming the leadership of Britain, you ask what our policy is, it is victory at all costs. I think it would be disastrous for us to do anything but crush the opponents. And I think it's somewhat irresponsible for the political debate this partisan year to take shape in a way that can lessen our resolve. I don't think the Bush administration is doing enough to make the public political case for crushing terrorism. The loss would be incalculable to our prestige around the world and indeed the respect that the terrorists would give us, or the fear they would have for us should we decide to fold our tent. And I really think that John Kerry ought to be doing more.
John, we have to take a break. We thank you so much for the call. And we put the question to our listeners about the violence in Iraq and also what the Pentagon's options are and should be. Is it time to send in more troops? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. And we're talking this hour about the new round of violence in Iraq and what might be the way forward. Is it time for the Pentagon to send in more troops? Joining us is Colonel Randy Gangle, Executive Director of the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities in Quantico, Virginia. Also Pam Hess, Pentagon Correspondent for United Press International. And on the phone lines, we have from Raleigh, North Carolina, Tony's calling in. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Oh, okay. No, I just wanted to say I think that it's too late to bring in the international community. I'll agree with the other gentleman that says we're going to have to do this on our own because the justification for going there, nobody bought. So now we're stuck with the problem as well as the cost of it. As far as whether or not we need more troops in, it seems to me that if we're really trying to get the Iraqis involved in saving their own country, we need to, if we want to increase troop strength, increase the amount of people that are training the Iraqi soldiers and the Iraqi units to take over their own country and back out of these areas that are hotbeds for our troops. I mean, we let them be in charge of providing security for their own country and let us take a less prominent role in hopes of saving our own troops and in light of a quicker exit.
All right.
It just doesn't seem to be any strategy for getting out of Iraq, and everybody that talks about the military, I've heard they want to use it like a hammer to beat our will into them.
All right, Tony, we take your point. And let me pose that question to Colonel Gangel. And also, you know, what does this tell us about how much the U.S. can rely on the Iraqi police? Because in numbers, they've gone from, I think, about 30,000 a year ago. Now there are almost 80,000 today. But we're told that many of them switch sides or just abandon their posts. Are they yet ready to assume the role that we need for them to have?
Well, clearly that's not the case, as we've seen some of the evidence has shown us. I think there's two points I would make. First, police are not the ideal agency to deal with an insurrection of this type. I mean, the average policeman carries a pistol on his hip, and the opponents that we're facing here are using mortars, RPGs, automatic weapons, etc. So you need a military force to deal with that. Second point I would make is, and the caller from North Carolina, Tony, I believe his name was absolutely right. We do need to train an Iraqi army, and those steps are now underway. In fact, there was an announcement, I believe, 2 or 3 days ago that General Petraeus, who had been the commanding general of the 101st Airborne Division, has now been assigned to go back into Iraq and take charge of that effort to train the Iraqis, the new Iraqi army, as it's being called, in order for them to do these types of things and enable us to start our withdrawal back out of Iraq.
And Pam, inside the Pentagon, I wonder if you hear any discussion about whether the effort to contain Sadr may have backfired. I mean, his newspaper was closed. We're hearing that his posters are being pulled down from walls. Did that make him more important than he might have been otherwise?
The military has had a sort of a low-level psychological operations campaign against Muqtada Sadr from the start that I would say up until very recently was actually pretty successful. And their idea basically was to officially ignore him and not confer upon him the status as an opposition leader. They didn't want to deal with him directly. And the way they've been dealing with him is through the clerics of Najaf, who are sort of in control of the Shiism in Iraq. And they have a good relationship with these clerics who are the Hauza, which is sort of the network of schools that are there that teach. And they have a good relationship with Sistani, although not a direct one. So they have allowed, and I think probably very intelligently, allowing the Shiites to keep Muqtada Sadr in a box, and they have largely done that. There are a few unanswered questions, though, that I think time will tell on exactly what went wrong with Sadr. First, there was an arrest warrant put out for him, but it was put out several months ago by an Iraqi judge. Why they're just acting on it now is very unclear. I'd point out that today you have the Interior Security Minister of Iraq has been forced to resign and has been replaced. They're trying to make this Sadr operation one that is controlled by the Iraqis, but it didn't happen for 3 months. And the question has to be asked, why didn't it happen? Did they not have the Iraqi buy-in? Was there something that was wrong with security forces that they weren't willing to go after this guy earlier instead of now when we're getting so close to the handover, when obviously this is a time when things are going to be more explosive there? So my sense of Sadr is that he was in a box probably until 3 or 4 weeks ago. And for whatever reason, they decided then was the time that they needed to move against him. It might have something to do with the anniversary of the death. I'm not sure. So I guess I can't give you a really good answer, just to say that there are lots of questions. And I think that we might find the answers in looking at Iraqi security, the Iraqi security forces, and what role they're playing in this.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. From Durham, North Carolina, let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. I guess I got a couple of comments. One of them is, it seems to me, actually, that this is a good time for such an uprising to occur, because it seems to involve several independent militias, and we really need to defang these militias before the elections. Otherwise, we have a very serious danger of ending up with a situation like Afghanistan, where the government controls the capital and little else. And that's really an unacceptable outcome, in my opinion. The other thing is to keep in mind that a lot of the same people that are in the streets angrily protesting now, it's entirely possible that they were the same ones angrily protesting and supporting Saddam Hussein before he fell, you know, chanting against the Americans, and then the same ones helping to pull down his statue gleefully when he fell. I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that politics over there is different from politics in Western democracies.
All right, Mike, appreciate the phone call. And Colonel, I wonder if you'd speak to Mike's points and also the broader question here about Iraqi civilian casualties, because if hundreds more civilians are killed in this fighting, you have to assume that they're not going to say that the fighting is the fault of the Muslim community. It's the Americans who did it.
You've hit on what I consider one of the most difficult challenges that we face. It's the carrot and the stick, if I could use that analogy. How much carrot do we give? Do we tempt people with? And then, if that doesn't work, how much stick do we have to apply? Certainly, nobody wants to kill anybody who is not an armed combatant. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And we go to great lengths to try to train our forces to be selective or discriminate. Unavoidably, casualties will occur. And as the intensity of battle goes up, so will the number of non-combatant casualties. I think what we have to do, what is being done, is there has to be a concurrent psychological warfare or information operations campaign conducted so that people are told, look, if you will tell us where the insurgents are, whether you are pro us or not, we will go in, deal with them, and leave you alone. You will be the better for it. But if you don't tell us, and we have to go in and do it the hard way, there are going to be people who suffer and die, unfortunately, because we don't have the precise information that we require. One of our major deficiencies in the military is our inability to gather precise intelligence or information in the urban battle space. You know, all of our billions of dollars invested in overhead imagery systems such as satellites and UAVs, et cetera, just don't work and don't give us anything in this urban battle space. It is dirty, rotten business, and the only way we can get the information is from the people who are there, and that these guerrillas who are not wearing uniforms or insurgents or not wearing uniforms or not easily identified move in and amongst the people. The people themselves have to be convinced by some form, whether it's the carrot or the stick, to give us the information so that we don't have to harm them in the process of putting down this rebellion.
Let's take another call now. Eddie's on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Eddie, and welcome.
Hey, Gail. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned that the war was not going as it was thought, but I beg to differ. That was someone else's thought, because it's going exactly the way that most of the people that I know, educators and learned people that have studied and worked with people in the Middle East, including me, thought that it was going to go. The other thing is that we've lived in a democracy here in the United States for over 200 years, with a background going back all the way to Rome. And if you notice that the people in the Middle East did not like the Roman system of government, and whereas we did, and we only participate, about one-third of the American people even bother to vote. Now, what gives us the idea that those people over there are going to follow a democracy when we don't even do it?
Hmm. Eddie, interesting question. Pam, you want to speak to that?
that's a tough one. And that gets into actually an enormous debate that has been obscured of late because of the renewed violence in Iraq, but just what the agenda is that the Bush administration has for the Middle East. I would point you to some speeches that have been made. There was one that you can find on the Pentagon's website back in November from Doug Feith, talking about this idea of remaking the Middle East into sort of a bastion of democracy and trying to bring up freedom there. They don't have much experience with it. That's true. I really don't feel qualified to answer this question. I mean, it's a PhD thesis on what the likelihood of things happening the way we want them to go. But I would say that I've actually been remarkably impressed at the general Iraqi people's ability to sort of withstand this year-long occupation. I've got to think that if the United States was undergoing something like this, we might be even more resentful and resistant to having a foreign force there.
Well, and it's also interesting
people do get killed.
If you look,
yes,
Pam,
I'm sorry, go on.
I was going to say it's interesting to note in the Arab press, or at least the more moderate press, you see more about what Al-Sistani says in urging a peaceful solution than what Sadr is saying. That is much more inflammatory, and I wonder what that tells you about how the wider Arab world is viewing this current round of fighting.
I don't have much to offer you on the wider Arab world, but I did get an email from a friend I know in Baghdad who has been talking with Shiites, and they point out that Muqtada Sadr, you know, is the son of this great grand Ayatollah, and they have feelings of affection for him for that, but that their loyalty lies with Sistani. And Sistani is an incredibly interesting guy. He's actually Iranian, the line that he takes and what he does has actually been incredibly consistent from the start. He's really trying to stay out of politics and only gets into it when he's sort of forced by events. But he's really trying to allow this process to take place and has been probably the biggest advocate for some form of democracy taking place in Iraq. I would say even bigger than the U.S. And it causes the Coalition Provisional Authority some heartburn periodically that Sistani is often taking the high road on democracy.
And Colonel, let me ask you for a closing thought about how you see morale. What do you hear? What do you know about what the morale is now among U.S. troops?
Well, I can't speak for all U.S. troops. I can talk for the Marines that I deal with. Morale is very high in the Marine Corps. They're committed to their job. I don't see any problems at all in that arena. In fact, you know, what we have to recognize is we have a professional army today. We did not have a professional army in Vietnam. And the people that join the military today join it because they know what they're joining for. They're going off to fight the nation's battles, be they right or wrong. And these troops that we have and these officers, well-led, they're in there and they're going to do the job. They're going to do it well. And that's what they're doing, what they signed up to do.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now, actually, Pam. I'm sorry we're out of time, but we thank you both so much for being with us. Colonel Randy Gangle is the executive director of the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities in Quantico, Virginia. Thanks, Colonel.
You're sitting in a helicopter with that.
And Pam Hess is the Pentagon correspondent for UPI. Actually, I don't think you're in a helicopter now, Colonel, but we thank you for being with us. Earlier, we spoke with Kathy Hillman, whose son Tony is with the National Guard in Iraq. And Thanasi Kambanis is reporter for the Boston Globe in Baghdad. You can continue the conversation in our online forums at theconnection.org. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR.